You know, looking at these data and any other available data, do you see the path to any of these agents coming into clinical trial or clinical usage in the next couple of years?
Well, I think all of these VEGF receptor tyrosine kinase inhibitors are potent drugs. I think they're good drugs. The question is, do these agents need to go head-to-head with bevacizumab, or can they have a registration strategy where they simply show approval above chemotherapy alone or equivalency to the regimens plus bevacizumab? And I'll ask my colleagues around the table in regards to this registration strategy.
What about the so-called issue, you know, vertical targeting using Bev plus these TK inhibitors?
Well, it's important to point out that even though they're targeting the VEGF pathway, they're targeting different parts of the VEGF pathway. When you utilize bevacizumab, you are inhibiting activation of VEGF receptor 2, partial activation of VEGF receptor 1, and neuropilin, which is a co-receptor for VEGF, which we think has function on tumor cells itself. When you inhibit the VEGF receptors with tyrosine kinase inhibitors, you're inhibiting the activity of VEGF R1, R2, and R3, but you're not inhibiting neuropilin. So by combining both bevacizumab and the TKIs, you may get total shutdown of the VEGF system, which has been shown to lead to an increase in toxicity, but the patients do seem to tolerate it. There was a trial reported at ASCO by Elise Cohn's group from the NCI, where most of the patients were patients with metastatic ovarian cancer, and there were a number of fistulas that occurred by total shutdown of the VEGF system.
In terms of the data that he presented, in terms of, you know, the efficacy or any other data you've seen with some of these agents, particularly 6474 and 2171, any thoughts about whether there's anything there or not, Herb?
I don't know that there's enough data that's been presented to even gauge how to make suggestions for investment banking and speculation. There is absolutely not enough data to have this be an issue for general practice. And because there's the potential for the concepts to be extrapolated, I think we should be particularly careful. So, for example, there are PDGFR inhibitors which are available, and that is namely imatinib, is commercially available. Combination of that agent with bevacizumab makes sense for a mouse and for a pilot study, or with sunitinib. Double combinations may have particularly augmented toxicity. There have been reported cases of profound toxicity, including stroke and other CNS changes, malignant hypertension, and as Lee mentioned, in the ovarian cancer study with sorafenib, the VEGF-RAF inhibitor in combination with bevacizumab, a markedly higher risk of perforation, with caveats that it was a patient group who may have been predisposed. I think it's very careful that we in this group be careful to segregate, again, what's a good idea for research versus something that's ready for doctors and patients to seriously discuss, even in the context of off-label use, to individualize therapy, even for patients in significant need. I don't think any of this is ready for that kind of a discussion.
How about from a research perspective? Do you find this exciting, not too exciting? What do you think?
I think the idea of if a little bit's good, should more be investigated, makes sense. However, I do not know how that will work as far as efficacy or toxicity. One can easily imagine that you have a threshold effect by drugging an axis, and if you double drug the axis, you actually get very little added benefit. The same may or may not be true on toxicity, where a lot may depend upon physiologically redundant pathways where a little bit of VEGF signaling is needed to keep the normal vasculature healthy. So I don't know how to prejudge what would happen to efficacy, safety, therapeutic index until adequately powered studies are done.
Axel and then Jordan.
Within NCTG, we're going to initiate three trials with sorafenib and bevacizumab in combination. One in recurrent glioblastoma, one in second-line colon cancer, and one in hepatocellular carcinoma, although the dose of sorafenib is not clear in this regard. So we flank this with a lot of translational components because, again, highlighting that this is something that is interesting. It should be explored, but we need to control this very carefully.
Jordan?
I was just going to say, again, this is going to be vertical, such as those trials are going to be vertical inhibition, but they also have some horizontal because these TKIs are very sloppy. And they do...
They're promiscuous.
Yeah, promiscuous. Off-target. Well, I was trying to come up with a more polite word.
Right.
The bottom line is they're not interchangeable. So if sorafenib plus bevacizumab turns out to be useful or turns out to have some positive effects, it might not be the same for sunitinib or ZD, whatever number they want to come up with and subtract from another one. The bottom line is that they're so variable in what they inhibit that you're not really sure if you're truly inhibiting vertically or if some of the effect comes from another TKI you're hitting.
Bob?
Yeah, I think this whole discussion goes back to what you were asking us before with trastuzumab as the paradigm. I mean, the issue is, what is the best way to look at the molecular biology we know and then to take this onto a clinical study? And I have to say, I think one of the things we have is preclinical models that really can predict better for us what's going to happen in the clinic, because basically, the people around this room are talking about an empiric trial of combining things to inhibit in a vertical pathway and maybe some horizontal crosstalk. We don't have the resources, I don't think, to study every combination imaginable at the clinical level, and we have to have preclinical signals that justify us to do this. Just as one example, I think it's pretty clear that fluoropyrimidine plus oxaliplatin is truly synergistic preclinically and obviously clinically. But we're not really holding drug combinations, whether they're cytotoxics or molecular agents, to any sort of threshold to kick them into clinical investigation. And I think we're going to have a lot of time and resources wasted if we don't get models that tell us this is really a smart thing to do and we need to investigate this further in people.
Lee, where are we in terms of models?
Well, as a mouse doctor, I will say that mice are incredibly non-predictive. They're only predictive of careers for preclinical researchers, but not for clinical trials. So we have shifted away from doing the models which actually respond and are starting to study models where we don't get a good response, which is more akin to what happens in the clinic. A question that I have...
Like what? What kind of models?
Well, for instance, there was a pancreatic cancer model, L3.6PL, which was developed at our institute, which responds to everything. And it has been published by multiple people, but it has never mirrored what has happened in the clinic. So we are using more refractory pancreatic cancer cell lines, doing more orthotopic models. One of the problems with the transgenic models is that most of them don't metastasize. And we treat metastasis. So in colon cancer, we don't really have good models. Even though there are some good mouse models of colon cancer, we don't have any metastatic transgenic models of metastatic disease. The question I want to raise is that as we've asked the IBET question and we look at the BRIGHT data, is it worthwhile to study an agent like 2171 or axitinib or any of these other agents after patients have progressed on bevacizumab in the frontline setting to do a little shift in inhibiting the VEGF axis by using a different agent?
What do you think about that, Axel?
I think it's a good idea. I mean, there are some preliminary sunitinib data. The phase 2 trial, which kind of subgroup patients who had had bevacizumab who did not, there was not a lot of signal out there. But with all these small studies, we might not get a good signal until we go into a larger trial.
I mean, is it feasible to study any of these agents in this so-called Optimox window when you're not doing anything?
There's no data to support it, but there's no data to refute it, which means it requires study.
You know, the kind of research that you just presented on some of these agents, is that the way we should be studying these drugs?
I think those type of trials should be supported only by the drug companies. This is certainly something that the NCI should not support because there are over 20 anti-VEGF agents out there, which is the largest category of drugs ever developed targeting a single molecule or single pathway.
But I mean, regardless of who's paying for it, is that the way to look at it?
Well, are you suggesting that it be used as monotherapy during the hiatus?
Maybe. I don't know. You tell me.
A lot of this is really signal above noise, which in the end of the day is how much clinical benefit is likely to be added to whatever else is going on. In general, double hits on the same target, one hit, if it's bioactive, will get you some clinical activity. The second hit needs to move clinical activity from moderate to good range up to a higher level, and that's much harder to see. My suspicion is all of these alternative ways of drugging the VEGF pathway all make sense. But the good news is there is at least the axis has been studied enough that the hypothesis that the drugging of the VEGF axis will affect other receptor binding other ligands, and that this may have an effect, are all actually fairly testable in modest-sized numbers of patients. And I think the evidence that those presumed mechanisms of resistance are actually applying are going to be fairly helpful to help prioritize which of these to actually use.
Norm, in terms of drug development, is this the way it needs to be?
I don't know. I wish I had a very clear focus, you know, on that, and I don't. I think Lee's comments, you know, is something that many of us hold as absolute truths. I agree. We need predictive models. We need predictive preclinical models. We don't have predictive preclinical models. Should we go to small randomized phase 2 trials, randomized or unrandomized, if we have a very good idea of what the expectations are at baseline, and simply, you know, find a bioassay that will at least give us an indication or cull out drugs or determine the appropriate combinations and determine statistically what our endpoints are going to be. We're not there.
Charlie?
Akin to that, I worry that all of these phase 1 and 2 studies of TKIs, much against the VEGF pathway and other pathways, at the end of the day, I do wonder whether we'll actually understand which of these agents should move forward into larger studies. I really doubt we'll be able to do that from that data.
Lee?
One of the development strategies comes within the companies when they have another agent which targets EGFR or IGF-1R or whatever it is. The companies are combining these agents. So hopefully we will get some novel therapeutic regimens because of the drugs that they have on the shelf. As far as mixing and matching, there's no rationale for that except for the fact that the companies already have these drugs and it would be to their advantage to combine them and hopefully see a benefit.
Axel?
2 points. First of all, a lot of what you presented in terms of your overview focus on response rates as one of the endpoints. And I don't think this is probably the right measure for a lot of these biologic agents. We probably have to be more innovative in terms of, you know, defining appropriate endpoints like progression-free survival rate at a certain time point, which is more a time-related endpoint. The second point is an article that Dan Sargent pointed me to when we talked about the problem that we have a lot of drugs out there right now that we'd all like to move forward and perhaps sometime introduce into clinical practice. There's an interesting paper in pediatric oncology. And they have the problem that they have a small number of patients and they want to move things forward in clinical trials. And they modeled certain aspects like, what about if we conduct smaller trials with a higher expectation of what should be a positive outcome, and we might discard some of the active drugs which have marginally beneficial effects. We might actually adopt the wrong agent at some point, but over time, this is a more successful strategy, rapidly cycling through, let's say, a decade of repetitive phase 2-like trials and basing our current new standard of care, a new control arm, onto the phase 2-defined superior regimen, then waiting to accrue, let's say, 3 or 4 randomized trials with about 1,000 patients that give us a marginal benefit. So modeling in this kind of patient number versus available agent trial design number scenario is in favor of cycling through a rapid succession of smaller trials with larger benefit assumption rather than waiting for the large phase 3 trials. Very interesting paper.